This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your company. Well, it's been a bit of a busy fire season in parts of Queensland. Tens of thousands of hectares of land was burnt recently through the northwest. And those lightning strike fires reportedly travelled between the towns of Normanton and Croydon, which is an area that stretches across about 150 kilometres. Thankfully, rain fell at the right time to extinguish the blazes after weeks of firefighting from fireys, landholders, that even involved the water bombing helicopter that had to be called in. Now, there's concern these new environmental laws will make it harder to manage tree-dense land during bushfire seasons. In late November, the federal government announced they would be tightening controls for land clearing and increasing fines for breaches. Southwest Queensland grazier Karen Tickle tells Madeline McCosker the changes would likely impact how they use fire as a management tool.
Yeah, we're still not too bad. We've still got plenty of dry feed. We've had three pretty good seasons in a row, so things are pretty good in that respect, but you know, getting pretty dry now, starting to look for a few storms, but be nice, hopefully they're on their way soon.
I know there are a lot of people hoping for some nice rain in the lead up to Christmas, but you mentioned that there's been three good seasons in a row, which obviously leads to lovely thick pasture, but it also means big fuel loads. So can you talk to me, I guess, about how that sets up a fire season? If you've had these big seasons behind you, what that leads into during a summer and when it is particularly dry?
Oh, we've just got a lot of big fuel load, even in our scrub country as well. And, you know, it can't complain, they've been great seasons, but, and probably due to the federal changes to the EPBC Act that we're probably going to see more of these, you know, due to the thickening problems we've had, we've got more and more scrub and more vegetation. So the fires are only going to probably be larger every year because we can't control that regrowth anymore. So I think we're just have to, grit our teeth and be prepared. I think from now on, I think there's just going to be more and more of these sort of fires, I think, due to the vegetation management is probably a big concern for us, you know.
How do you manage that risk of fire at this time of year?
You know, we get in early, we get all the fire breaks in, try and get all that managed, you know, give your laneways a bit of a touch-up with cattle so you got bigger, wider breaks. It would be nice to probably get some wider fire breaks in if we could, but once again, we're restricted to the Vegetation Act with how wide we can clear our fire breaks now, which, you know, does cause a few issues.
And you've said that you're already seeing some fires around your part of the world. You had one last night around Orgathella. So I guess, can you talk to me a little bit about what you've seen so far over this sort of summer period?
Yeah, I think everybody's had their fair share. We've had a few now. We had a good one a couple of nights ago. Burned a couple of thousand acres out on the neighbour's place, but we got a bit lucky. The rain gods opened up and saved our bacon there on dark. But we had another one up at Orgathella about a month ago that, didn't even know it. It was a lightning strike, started a fire, you know, burnt five or ten acres out. Rain put it out, and then 2 weeks later we're up there processing some steers and looked out and, holy dooly, half the paddock was on fire. It had burned underground through a tree root and the tree had fallen over and away it went again. So we're just fortunate. We had a bit of machinery on hand and got around it. But, I think just having your brakes in place and being prepared, I think, is one of the biggest things, I think, these days.
How concerned are you over the next few months about what's to come, especially, you know, that the Bureau summer forecast suggests that there's going to be less rain over this summer period? So, you know, how concerned are you for what's to come over the next few months? What could the situation be in that period without rain?
We just have to have our guard up, you know, just be ready. Like, it's just something that happens every year. It's nothing new to us, I think. We've just been spoiled in the last few years. It's broken early for us and the grass has greened up. But, we've got to be ready for it this year. But it's probably just, you know, a few of the concerns we have a few of the carbon properties around here really aren't prepared enough. They probably don't have people on these properties anymore, so fires can start in them, and then, you know, they can come out into you over a huge front where you've got sort of nobody controlling them. And we really had the nappy site's been very unreliable. I don't know what's going on with it. Sometimes it's unbelievable. It'll pick up if you burn your sausages on a backyard barbecue, but can't pick up 2,000 acres burning, you know. I don't know what's going on there. We had that fire 2 nights ago, didn't show up for 10 hours. We're trying to find, locate where these fires are, and it's very hard to get a gist on it, you know.
And we were hearing a bit as well from different sort of RFS crews and volunteer groups that maybe there's not a lot of equipment or enough equipment to help with these sort of fires when they do pop up. What's the situation for you? Are you part of a volunteer crew with your neighbouring properties? How does that all work out your way?
Yeah, we're in a couple of different brigades out here, and the local fire fella in charge there, Tyrone's been pretty good. You know, everybody's been trying to update here lately. They've really probably stepped up in the last 12 months, I think, in trying to prepare everybody with, you know, there's old slip-on units, 10, 15 years old with old Brits and Stratton motors on them. So we're just trying to update that gear at the moment, they've been really helpful, which has been great. We've probably just got to be a little bit more proactive and have that stuff ready for when we do need it, because it's normally only until you get a fire and you get a scare that you normally go out and get your gear organised, you know. So.
Yeah, when you realise what you're missing when you need it.
Yeah, that's right. Normally by then she's through the one paddock into the next one, but no, we can't. They have been very good to deal with, but yeah. So.
That's Charleville grazier Cameron Tickle speaking with Madeline McCosker. Now, a spokesperson from the Northern Australia Fire Information told the ABC in a statement that these maps are based on an automated feed of these hotspots that is sourced from overpassing satellites by organisations like Geoscience Australia and Landgate. They said that these satellites are operated by the US or European space agencies, and the reliability of these hotspot maps can vary, but they have no control over this. They said most hotspots are sourced from satellites that pass overhead at intervals throughout the day, and most of these overpasses are in the afternoon or very early morning. And also, the fire detecting satellites cannot see through cloud. And this year, there's been more cloud cover over a lot of Queensland than there has been the last couple of years. And the NAFI spokesperson said that the fact we have almost no control over these fire detecting satellites when they might cease operating or be replaced is the Achilles heel of fire detection across remote Australia. In the Charters Towers region, though, local fire brigades are also sharing similar concerns to grazier Cameron Tickle over these environmental laws after 1,200 hectares of land was burnt in the area last year. Secretary for Betts Creek Rural Fire Brigade and grazier from Pentland, Yvonne Schaefer, says it's important that fire breaks are able to be wide enough for better safety in firefighting efforts.
So this year we've had a really quiet fire season, and my biggest concern is in a couple of years' time when it all ramps up again, simply because we've had everything burn last year, so it's not going to be a problem this year. We are going to be in the same situation we've always been, where fire breaks are not wide enough for two vehicles to pass, and they're certainly not wide enough for a vehicle to turn around. It's okay if it's in a area where it is flat and not many trees, turn around easily. But in this rough terrain with lots of trees and lots of wattle, it can cause a massive problem where people can get stuck and vehicles can get stuck inside a fire area.
And with these new laws in particular, what is your concern with, I guess, not knowing at the moment how this will, you know, look like for fire breaks?
I haven't had time to read through them or to go into them. I think it's more not knowing where we are, how we stand, and who's responsible for if we're grading lines and if we're, you know, having to widen breaks. Who's responsible then for the grading of those lines and the potential felling of a clearing that's too wide?
And now I have heard from some people that the new hotline is, you know, taking a while to get their answers to some of these questions like this one. What's your reaction to that, you know, hearing that?
Well, for us in this area, We're just damn lucky that it hasn't been a massive fire season, because if it had, we would need those answers. We're in a position now where we have got a bit of time to find out these answers, but it was just luck that that's happened, and it was only because we all burnt last year that is the case. We just need clarity, I think, and basically we need to have fire breaks wide enough that if a vehicle needs to turn around, it needs to be able to turn around and be safe.
That's Pentland Grazier Yvonne Schaefer speaking to Brooke Tindall. And in response to questions from the ABC, a spokesperson from the Department of Environment said in a statement, in the case of emergency bushfire suppression and containment activities, protecting life and property is always the overriding concern. National Environment Law generally does not restrict responses required to manage bushfire emergencies, nor does it regulate measures taken to fight fires. The minister is also able to grant national interest exemptions for emergency response if required. Fire prevention activities are unlikely to need approval if they involve maintenance of existing fire breaks, access tracks, and fire control infrastructure. Splashing alongside existing tracks, including weed control to create a defendable zone, maintenance of existing asset protection zones, and continuing an established cycle of controlled burns. Now, the Environment Department spokesperson said clearance of new fire breaks and other substantial works outside of an emergency situation may require federal approval if there is likely to be a significant impact on a nationally protected matter. Examples of this would be clearance of vegetation that results in irreversible or permanent loss of nationally threatened communities or key habitats for threatened species. And if landowners are planning on an activity that they think might have a significant impact on any nationally protected matter, they can call the department's contact centre for assistance. It is 17 minutes past 12. Up next, how AI is being used in agriculture.
Committed to keeping you informed and in touch with your community. ABC Local Radio.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
There's a growing trend of farmers using artificial intelligence to answer some of their farming questions. The trend is particularly evident on social media platform X, where farmers are using the Grok AI tool. Jonathan Dyer, who farms in Western Victoria, says it's become a useful resource.
Yeah, it's becoming fairly quickly, really, a handy tool. You can just ask it questions, and I found the key to give it a bit of context about your location and what you're doing, and that, it's becoming quite an interesting sounding board.
And what sorts of questions are you asking it?
Yeah, we've just sort of been mucking around with it, I guess, sort of learning how it works and how best it does work. But, for instance, a couple of weeks ago, I did come across with this cool, damp finish to the season we're having, a bit of a paddock weed situation that I probably wasn't too comfortable with. And so I did the normal thing the right thing and asked the agro and got some advice on it. But at the same time, I asked Grok as well, and the recommendations they both came up with were nearly identical. So it's, becoming quite an interesting tool.
And there are lots of AI tools out there that you can use, but with Grok particularly, because the conversation plays out on the X platform, is that more useful because other farmers can then jump in and contribute their own information or ask Grok their own questions?
I think that's right. Yes, that's the social aspect to it. And, look what I found. Yeah, the Google's got one that's supposedly quite good as well. I haven't tried it. But the other thing about Grok, Angus, is people that are far smarter than I, rank these things in terms of their, ability to not hallucinate and make things up, as these new tools sometimes do. And Grok's certainly not perfect in that respect, so I don't think any of them are, but it's sort of ranked as good as any of them in terms of, being able to get to the truth of the matters and not make things up if it doesn't know.
And on that point about it not being perfect, and you gave the example of, cross-checking against what your agronomist said. So at that stage, is that still what you're doing, not necessarily taking it at face value, but maybe using it as a starting point and then referencing it against what you know or what you can find out from other sources?
Yeah, that's definitely where we're at. We're not replacing a person anytime soon, but it's, I guess, a bit of a confidence booster. Like, if those two sources match up, you're possibly on the right track. So, yeah, it's just another tool, and sometimes it's a busy time of year, right? People are off doing different things, and just for a quick second opinion, it's just there in your pocket, isn't it?
And you made the point that AI and Grok and the others, they didn't even exist not that long ago, and now they're proving somewhat useful. So how quickly do you think they'll get better and more useful?
Well, I think it's going to keep going. To the point we'll be able to ask kind of natural language type questions of these tools, and they'll give you, again, not necessarily perfect all the time, but pretty good answers. And they're a great sort of starting point.
And further to that point, Jono, I guess it sort of can't think independently. It's really just scanning and aggregating data. So do you need to be careful of if someone maybe uses something like sarcasm in a question, it doesn't detect the sarcasm and it comes up with a completely false answer?
Yeah, that sort of thing sort of can occasionally happen, but they are getting better and better, Angus, even at kind of detecting tone. So it will sometimes notice things like that. I think the thing that I've found with it is giving it context. So basically all these AI tools, they're either developed in America or China. And so they're kind of biased to wherever they're made a bit. So like, I've been asking about chemical questions, and sometimes they get back products that are available in the US that aren't available here or something like that. So fine, you've got to give them context. I'm in Victoria, I'm in the Wimmera, I'm dealing with in this crop, dealing with this problem. That helps it to really kind of focus in on what you're talking about. If you have a preference for, you want only information for the GRDC, you can even ask it to say, hey, I've got this question, focus mainly on these resources in giving your answer, and then it'll kind of zone in on those particular resources or places that you trust or think are better. So, yeah, you do have to look out for the BS, but there are also ways of using the tools that filter a bit.
And putting Grok aside, Jono, this is something we talked about before, just how useful are these platforms like X and others for farmers, particularly in terms of information sharing and posing questions and getting farmers from all over Australia or all over the world to answer them for you?
Yeah, hugely valuable, and this has been going on since before these tools were around. Farming, as we know, can at times be isolating, and you're sitting in that cab by yourself for hours at a time, which people like me appreciate, but I understand others are more social and enjoy the interaction, and it's not the same as face-to-face, but it does give you a sense of what's going on in your industry and connection to other farmers, a bit like you do at the footy on the weekend or your other social, or the pub or social institutions. You can kind of do a bit of these spitballing online scenarios where you just shoot the wind and, problem solve.
That's Jonathan Dyer, who farms in Western Victoria, speaking with Angus Furley about how he uses a particular artificial intelligence tool.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app, this is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Now, we're anticipating a national address from the Prime Minister at 12:30, which I will bring to you live. So we're talking today to the Bureau of Meteorology early to make sure we get the weather cross in. Baden Gilbert joins me now. Good afternoon, Baden.
Good afternoon.
So what's the major watch points around the state this week?
So for the next couple of days in Queensland, maybe we'll start talking about some of the storms that we have got. For today, we do have a line of storms that have just started to pick up in the past hour or two, stretching from roughly Longreach down towards the north of Roma and in towards roughly around that Kingaroy area to the inland of the Sunshine Coast. The risk of storms for the rest of today is pretty broad across much of the state. Maybe not so much along the east coast for northern and far north Queensland, but pretty much the rest of the state could see a storm at some point during today. There is also a risk that we could see some slow-moving thunderstorms about the central interior. And if you are under one of those slow-moving thunderstorms, you could see an accumulation of rainfall that could lead to heavy rainfall if it persists. So that's something we'll be monitoring for as we go into today and be putting out any warnings if it looks like that is occurring. As we go into tomorrow, that risk will spread down in towards the southern interior. So for communities like Roma, down towards St. George, and then across the border from there. And in addition to that, we'll also just see a broader area of moderate falls about the central and parts of the southern interior. also stretching somewhat into the Sunshine Coast, which could definitely have a bit of a wetter Tuesday than they've had in the past little while. The other thing I'll say on the showers is that as we go into Wednesday, we're going to see those showers return to the East Coast, or from Tuesday into Wednesday, but with a particular focus of that rainfall on Wednesday about the North Tropical Coast, we could see some moderate accumulations about the Cassowary Coast and the Jane Tree Coast, where we could definitely see more than 50 millimetres on the cards for communities in that area. So a bit of moisture about, a bit of rainfall about.
What's driving that rainfall?
So the rainfall in the interior is largely due to the combination of a trough sitting through the interior, as well as a upper feature that's sort of stalling over that part of the world and just giving everything a bit more of a boost for the next couple of days before it actually retrogresses back into the Northern Territory before it weakens out at the end of the week. Along the coast, we do have a southeasterly change that's just making its way through the southeast of the state right now. But as we go into tomorrow and into Wednesday, that will make its way right up the Queensland coast and become more of a southeasterly surge in those winds. And that will just enhance onshore flow, enhance moisture pushing onto the ranges, which will enhance rainfall in those areas.
So can coastal waters expect, increased winds and swells this week?
Yeah, for sure. So as we go into, particularly for the southeast today, but beyond that, Tuesday and Wednesday, we'll see definitely a real freshening of those east and southeasterly winds along the east coast. We could also see a couple of coastal wind warnings being issued. I believe currently we're maybe looking at considering one for the Capricornia coast on Wednesday and maybe even the Sunshine Coast for tomorrow. So definitely make sure if you're heading out of the water, you keep an eye on the forecast with those thresher winds possible as we go through the next couple of days.
And how is all this rain and unsettled conditions going to impact temperatures this week?
So temperature-wise, it's been a bit of a warmer day for most of the state today, and has also been in recent days as well. Maybe a little bit cooler about the central interior today with just that more cloud cover and more shower and storm activity present. As we go into Tuesday, we see an area of actually below average temperatures form underneath that bit of more moisture and a bit more cloud cover, stretching roughly from the northwest through to the southeast of the state, capturing the central interior as well. And that'll even spread out a little bit more as we go into Wednesday before focusing into the northwest of the state as we go into Thursday and Friday.
And I saw that there's also a tropical low hanging around the Northern Territory. What sort of impact will that have on weather this week?
Yeah, indeed. So we're looking at an area or a trough just sitting to the north of the Northern Territory at the moment. There's potential for that to, form into a tropical low as we go into the next couple of days. So we'll be watching that area quite closely as we go into this week. Some earlier guidance was suggesting that would move into the middle of the Gulf of Carpentaria as we went into Thursday and Friday. The latest forecast indicates that it should be more likely to be closer to the Northern Territory than Queensland if it were to enter the Gulf later this week. But of course, we will keep watching that system, and we're now giving it a moderate chance of developing into a tropical cyclone on Thursday into Friday.
Yeah, so definitely keeping an eye on that one.
Indeed, yeah, and yeah, at the moment, yeah, it's looking more like it'd be an impact for the Northern Territory, but even if it does end up in the western parts of the Gulf of Carpentaria, there could still be some additional impacts on the periphery for Gulf communities in Queensland.
Baden, thank you so much for your time today.
That's all good. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Baden Gilbert, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology.
Committed to keeping you informed and in touch with your community. ABC Local Radio.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Thank you for your company on the Country Hour today. So the federal government have announced that they are going to boost funding to competition watchdog ACCC to more closely monitor the two biggest supermarkets to prevent price gouging. So the new laws will come into effect in July next year, banning the two major supermarkets, Coles and Woolworths, from price gouging, with fines up to $10 million if they are found to have charged customers excessive prices when compared with the cost of supply plus a reasonable margin. Treasurer Jim Chalmers explains some of the new changes.
We are cracking down on price gouging by the big supermarkets. This is a commitment we took to the election. It is now law and it will come into being next year. This is all about making sure that families and pensioners get a fairer go at the checkout. We know that people are under pressure. We want to make sure, and we will make sure, that the supermarkets are not price gouging their customers. And that's what this important change is all about. We're also bringing in our cash mandate. Our cash mandate means that there is an obligation on supermarkets and fuel retailers to accept cash. This is all about ensuring that when Australians want to or need to use cash at the supermarket or the servo, that they can use cash. This is about making it easier for people to use cash to buy essentials at the supermarket and the servo.
Treasurer Jim Chalmers there. But Coles and Woolworths have slammed the federal government for excluding smaller supermarkets like IGA, Aldi and Costco from these new price gouging laws. A Woolworths spokesperson says leaving the smaller retailers out of the new laws is unprecedented and will create an uneven playing field. Coles has also hit back, saying multiple inquiries have found no evidence of price gouging by the two major supermarkets. To the dairy industry now. A surge in global dairy production and softer prices is expected to limit the prospect of any increase to the farm gate milk price over the next 6 months, according to Rabobank. Australian milk production is down 2.3%, but some recent rain in key dairy regions could see that trend start to turn around. Michael Harvey is the senior analyst with Rabobank, and he says it's been a mixed year for farmers, with both dry conditions and high inputs leading to a drop in overall production.
Yeah, look, it's been mixed, I would imagine, when you think about broadly the operating environment. I mean, clearly there's been some seasonal challenges for certain parts of the industry, and, you know, I'm thinking Tasmania, South Australia and Western Victoria being particularly hard hit in terms of dry conditions and what that's done. And broadly speaking then, you know, it's been a high cost of production environment for most dairy farmers around Australia as well. But hopefully things are starting to improve, at least on that front, with, you know, fertiliser prices drifting lower, purchase feed prices have come down. We've had some interest rate relief as well. So, yeah, it, from an operating environment, it's been mixed. And from a pricing perspective, I mean, it's been pretty good against a backdrop of what's going on globally, which is, you know, some deterioration in commodity markets around the world because of, you know, a shift in the fundamentals underpinning the global market, which is obviously leading to, you know, falling milk prices around the world, not rising milk prices, and where we've been immune from that so far this year.
So does it come back to supply and demand when you look at those big global players and a fair bit of milk coming onto the global market?
Exactly. I mean, there's no doubt the velocity of supply growth, which has been coming for a little while now, but the speed has certainly ramped up when you think about the major production regions around the world, you know, the European Union, the US.
We're breaking in now to bring you the coverage of the Prime Minister's press conference.
Flags will fly at half-mast across the country today as we pay our respects to all those lost and all those who have been injured. And we conclude by saying that yesterday was indeed a dark day in our nation's history, but we as a nation are stronger than the cowards who did this.
David, the opposition leader has also spoken this morning. She's accused the Prime Minister of not doing enough to stamp out anti-Semitism. What more is Susan Lee suggesting that Anthony Albanese could have done in this space?
Yeah, well, Susan Lee has gone in pretty hard today. She has said that anti-Semitism has been left to fester in Australia. There's been a failure of leadership to keep Jewish Australians safe. More should have been done to protect them. I mean, the opposition leader is coming close to blaming the Prime Minister, at least in part, for the environment that led to this happening. Take a look at some of what she's had to say.
Yes, there is anger. There is palpable anger. Because anti-Semitism in Australia has been left to fester. Many of us who've been close to the Jewish Australians, as I have been for the last 2 years, have heard story after story of hideous anti-Semitism. We've seen a clear failure to keep Jewish Australians safe. We've seen a clear lack of leadership in keeping Jewish Australians safe. We have a government that sees anti-Semitism as a problem to be managed, not evil that needs to be eradicated. Everything must change from today in how governments respond.
I think what we've seen today from Susan Lee is a marker of the pressure the government will now face after this incident. She is too reflecting some of the concern and anger that's there in parts of the Jewish community as well. But clearly there are dangers for the opposition here as well. If they are seen to be politicising this in any way, that could backfire on them. I think most Australians right now won't be thinking about the politics, but they will be demanding a bigger national response to something like this to keep the Jewish community safe and to ensure something like this can't happen again. So there are tests here, as you would expect in such a defining moment for all political leaders coming out of this.
Absolutely. David Spears, thanks very much for the analysis. Appreciate your time. And as we said, we are expecting to hear from the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, again a little later on today. We will bring you that press conference here on the News Channel as soon as we can.
That's right. Now, we are, of course, going to continue our Bondi coverage right across the day on the ABC News Channel. But we do need to get you across the latest bushfire situation in WA. In fact, there are two emergency warnings. This is north of Perth, and there is a fire at Mindara Red Gully and one at...
So that was the address on News 24. The Prime Minister hasn't spoken live yet, so we will bring you that one as it happens. I'll take you now to southeast Queensland, where there's proof that seagrass in Moreton Bay is being choked by layers of mud. And it's just one of the findings of 25 years of work on monitoring water quality in southeast Queensland. Andrew O'Neill is Healthy Land and Water's Chief Scientist and Sustainability Officer. He tells Jennifer Nichols the 2025 report card highlights the gains being made by working with farmers, as well as emerging risks like the increasing threat of algal blooms.
It's the only monitoring program like it in the world that's been going for such a long time, collecting such good data, and it's given us actionable insights over the years. But what it's able to do now with such a long data set is it's helping us to predict what will happen as we take interventions into the future. So it's becoming a bit of a time machine. So we can actually say to potential investors, look, if you do this, this is what's likely to happen. If you don't do this, this is also what's likely to happen.
Can we drill down into some of the results for the regions of the Palmerstone catchment, the Marucci catchment and the Noosa catchment and how they are faring?
Yeah, of course. So the Palmerstone catchment is in good condition this year. Over the years, it's varied. The Palmerstone has agricultural landscapes. It's got a growing urban footprint. So in flood years, it experiences quite a lot of sediment, just like the other catchments. The mud coverage of Moreton Bay is now very high. Seagrass recovers when it's a fairly thin covering of mud, but as the seagrass keeps getting covered by mud, it's really hard for seagrass to reestablish. So that's a big concern for Moreton Bay, is something that I'm quite concerned about for algal blooms in the future, and also for mud coverage of seagrass. Palmerstone's part of the Moreton Bay proper. Yeah, it's worrying because that's what, these iconic animals like dugong, that's what they eat. But this year, the freshwater parts of the Palmerstone are in excellent condition. They're in very good condition. And that trend is across the whole of southeast Queensland, but Palmerstone was particularly good. The other messages that are really important for the Palmerstone is, which are true also for the region, is that we are losing riparian vegetation. Riparian vegetation is that vegetation that fringes waterways. And it provides a huge ecological and environmental service by stopping the creek banks from eroding, shading the waterways, providing habitat and all that sort of thing. So we do see that across the region, we are losing quite a bit of that riparian area, and that is also true for the Palmerstone.
And what did it rate?
This year it's very good. So the highest is excellent and very good is the next highest. So it's very good. The concerns are some of the loads of pollutants like nitrogen and phosphorus. So these are nutrients that come from various different parts of catchment. They can come from agricultural context, they can come from urban, they can come from sewage treatment plants, and it does vary very locally as to where they come from, but those are up in the Palmerstone.
How did the Marucci catchment go?
So the Marucci is in fair condition, which is middle of the road. The freshwater wetlands are down. So freshwater wetlands are sort of like the kidneys, if you like, of a catchment. So that's something to keep an eye on for the Marucci.
When you say down, what do you mean?
It doesn't necessarily mean there's less of them, but there is only about 30% of the original extent of freshwater wetlands in the Marucci that there was pre-colonisation.
There's been a lot of work with that Blue Heart project that the council has invested heavily in. Has that had any good impact at all?
Yeah, so Blue Heart's probably one of the largest projects of its kind to restore freshwater wetlands anywhere in Australia. It's a really good project. So it has made a difference. It's very significant. And we'll start to see the effects, the positive effects of the Blue Heart and other projects like it flow on into the future. They do take a little while for the data to pick up those benefits. So yes, I do think that is a terrific project. The benefits will flow. We're just not seeing those benefits yet through the data.
And what about Noosa, which historically has always fared better because there's so much vegetation still left in place thanks to the national parks, the headwaters of the Noosa River?
So the Noosa's a special place in southeast Queensland, a special place in Australia, and it's still in very good condition. The freshwater health in particular in Noosa increased a lot this year because the Noosa has quite good intact riparian vegetation, so it doesn't experience the same effects of intense rainfall.
Now, Healthy Land and Water has been doing a lot of projects with the agricultural community. Mm. Can you talk about some of those and the impact that they're having?
Healthy Land and Water and other organisations too. So there are many organisations, GrowCom, QFF, AgForce, that work with the agricultural sector. Really important. I mean, I mentioned Palmerstone, but not just Palmerstone. You've got in the Sunshine Coast hinterland, you've got a vibrant agricultural sector up there. Working closely with farmers. That might be pineapple farmers in the Palmerstone, and it could be cattle, dairy and beef producers in the hinterland to help them understand what's happening with soil, what's happening with climate, make a bit of a plan, identify areas and hotspots for them. So there might be erosion happening on their property. You know, they might be curious about how they can get better productivity from their grass, because that's really, really important. But help them to not just understand, but help them to find ways to have a really positive environmental impact at the same time. So yeah, property management planning, soil workshops. We run lots of workshops and training. And we honestly, look, we learn just as much from farmers as they learn from us.
I know the pineapple farmers have been doing a lot of work to make sure that nutrient is staying on their land instead of running off, and also trying to reduce erosion. Are you impressed by the farmers' willingness to embrace change?
I am, and I think our sustainable agriculture team is as well. We've worked with Sam Pike, for example, in the Palmerstone. You know, farmers are so tuned in to what's happening on their property. They're so tuned into climate. They can see what's happening. They are really super engaged.
Andrew O'Neill is Healthy Land and Water's Chief Scientist and Sustainability Officer, speaking to Jennifer Nichols.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Jones. On Breakfast tomorrow, you'll hear local news, local weather and local stories. And of course, we'll keep you across all the big stories from around the country and the world. That's Breakfast tomorrow morning from 6:30 on ABC Capricornia.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Grain harvest is a round-the-clock job, and some are doing it on top of another 24-hour job. Being a parent, being a mum or a dad. Now, finding childcare can be quite difficult in rural areas. So what do you do with your baby during harvest? That's the question a new mum put out on social media, and she found plenty of parents in the same situation. Natasha Laws is mum to five-month-old baby Lainey, and this year was their first harvest together.
It's been really good. Like, it's definitely, it hasn't been a harvest without its struggles. We take two headers in our tractor and chase them into West Wyalong every year. We don't put it on a truck because it costs too much money. It's cheaper to just walk it there, which takes 4 hours. So trying to keep a sort of a five-month-old nearly entertained for 4 hours at 40 k's an hour definitely had its troubles. But my partner sort of, we've come to the conclusion that harvest this year was just going to be a little bit different. But she's taken it all in her stride, and she's been in the chase bin and in the header, and yeah, it's been an adjustment, but it's something that we needed to do, and it's our way of life. So,
And so your five-month-old daughter, you put a post up on social media asking for some advice, maybe from some other parents, of what to do with little babies. What was some of the reaction you got?
Yeah, so I put a post on the a Facebook page and just sort of asking, you know, like what other mums do with their babies in the tractors and how like they're keeping them comfortable, entertained and everything like that. And the response has been good, and like there was comments of other things that I didn't think of for as she gets older. So it was, you know, like making sure you put like a dog collar or a chain on the door so that they don't open it while you're driving and, you know, then potentially fall out. And just other like suggestions of like people using their capsules, but even suction caps and shade cloth that you can be able to then move around on the windows of the tractor to keep the shade off them, which I didn't even think of because I'd only had blankets hung over the door and muslin wraps tied on the steering wheel and things like that just to try and keep the sun off her a little bit. So it was definitely really good to hear other mums' perspectives and just see photos of their setups in their tractors. You're not the only person doing it. Like, farming is part of Australia. It's part of our livelihood, and there's plenty of mums everywhere doing it.
And how did she go in the header and in the tractor? She looks pretty comfy in the photo.
Yeah, she's been really good. She sort of has a few sleeps, and if she needs a decent sleep, I'll pop her in the carrier and sort of just drive around the paddock a little bit, and she sort of nods off pretty quickly. And then, yeah, it's just giving her a few toys, and obviously she's only 5 months old, so she doesn't need a lot, and she is also currently a breastfed baby, so I don't have to prepare bottles and things like that. So I think that makes life a little bit easier for her being in the tractor. She's been perfect. She put her in the header and she sits there and watches the reel spins around all afternoon, and she definitely enjoys it and pays. She's a very much a sticky beak baby, so she pays attention to everything and takes it all in. And yeah, give her another 4 years and she'll be driving it herself, I think.
Yeah, that's it. You can show her her first harvest when she's asleep in a little bed. Yeah.
Definitely.
I guess, were you surprised at the reaction you got? I mean, like, it seems like, yeah, lots of people had little tricks and tips, and yeah, lots of people are out doing harvest with babies on board.
Yeah, so I definitely didn't expect to get the reaction or even the amount of responses that I did. But then even just seeing other mums jumping on, or like future mums that like they're pregnant now and sort of also wondering how they're going to juggle that work-life balance, or even just like the family life balance, because, you know, the businesses and or working on farms where you've just got to sometimes jump in and help, you don't have the readily available facilities of like grandparents or even daycare to be able to sort of take the kids and drop them off when they're this little, or obviously there's no school. But yeah, just hearing other mums say that, you know, thank you for this because it's helped sort of get us prepared, and, you know, like they know that it is doable and that they can sort of have that work-life balance with Bub in the tractor. And it was good to see. And other mums sort of going, you know, props for, you know, good mum and, you know, taking Bub out and things like that. So it was really nice to hear and sort of uplifting at the same time.
That's a really good point you make too about daycare as well. I mean, is it even possible to get daycare or someone to come babysit while you're doing harvest?
Like, it's harder with daycare because obviously daycare have set hours. Our closest daycare for us is either 20 minutes to, like, for maybe 20 to 45 minutes at the most. Daycare shuts at sort of 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, so you've then got to get out of the tractor, drive half an hour, pick them up, and then potentially come back and sit back in the tractor after they've had a full day at daycare. But I'm originally from North Queensland, living in Nangus, New South Wales, and my family aren't here, and we only have my partner's family, and they also work. So it's just we don't have that capability of being able to just have someone come watch Lainey for a few hours. And, you know, it's just also at the same time, it's like we could be going till 2 a.m. or, you know, it's just harvest is very unpredictable. At the same time, you just sort of got to go with the flow.
You adapt and you make it work. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the biggest thing that people kept telling us when we were pregnant was that our lifestyle had to change. And I spent all harvest last year in the header. So we were going from 8 a.m. till 3 a.m. the following morning. And I knew that coming this year, those hours weren't possible having a baby. But at the same time, having the business, it's what puts our money on the table. It's what puts food in our house. keeps a roof over our head, pays our bills. So if we're short staffed for a day and I've got to go jump in a chaser bin for a few hours or drive a header for a few hours or escort our machineries, it's just what you have to do. And she's little enough that she'll just slot right in and fit into life. And as she gets older, she'll be like a really well-travelled baby.
That was Natasha Laws from New South Wales, who is getting into the harvest this summer season with her five-month-old baby, Lainey. She was speaking there to Annie Brown.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
Thank you for your company on the Country Hour today. It is 10 minutes to 1. A small town bakery can be the jewel of any main street in Australia, but for the last couple of years, one Central Queensland bakery has been shut as the family owners have navigated a dementia diagnosis for their much-loved baker. But they want you to know that Snow's Bakery is back up and running, as Hannah Walsh reports from Alpha.
When he got dropped off in Shakespeare Street, he looked the driver in the eye and he said, "Thanks, mate, I've travelled all this way to taste an Alpha pie."
They say in its heyday, the pies and sweet treats at Snow's reeled in travellers off Central Queensland's Capricorn Highway.
They were happy and excited. They said, "We've come from Gundagai. We've planned this trip for years to taste an Alpha pie."
Baking runs in the Tills brothers' blood. For most of his life, Chris Tills has woken long before dawn and kneaded dough. The rhythmic whirring of a mixer and comforting smell of yeast and sugar have kept him company.
We made a lot of pies here once, like at least 100 every day.
100 every day?
Yeah.
And the rest?
Oh, probably more, probably about maybe 400 some days.
400, yeah.
A lot of people come here.
But slowly Chris's memory has started to falter. Recipes he knew by heart were harder to remember.
So what's happened with Christopher, you know, he sort of, his health turned a bit for the worse about 3 years ago. And first things first, we had to try and sort of get his health in order before we could do anything with the business, and that kept us all pretty busy.
That's his younger brother, Peter. The recipes were passed down from their dad, so Peter noticed when they didn't taste quite right.
So it's gradual, so we didn't sort of realise that it was happening until just things weren't quite right. Things weren't quite right, the product wasn't quite right, things were forgotten, that sort of thing. And Chris, he sort of, we had a few rough years. We had our mother and sister die within a month of each other. And then Chris got COVID and he seemed to go right off the, you know, might have been a fair bit of grief involved, but the COVID really sent him. He was never sort of the same after that.
It took a little while for the family to realise, but ultimately Chris was diagnosed with dementia.
We didn't enjoy seeing what was happening to Christopher and his livelihood and the business and it's been such a big part of Chris's life and the family. We really sort of anchored to it because it's been a great, almost like a household name, so to speak, and around the West and around Queensland. And with the way his condition is, he just forgot to come down some days.
In the bakehouse, yeah. Tom, if he seen a snake, Tom wouldn't, he wouldn't think, he'd just race home and grab his tail and bash it on the concrete. That's what Tom used to do.
Yeah, who's Tom? So 2 years ago, the doors to Chris's bakery, Snow's Bakery in Alpha, were pulled shut and the ovens turned off.
Just in the last 3 or 4 months, I've been in a position where I could try and do something and bring the pies back.
Baking runs in the Tills brothers' blood. So Peter made the decision that he'd take over the operational duties under the guidance of Chris.
I mean, it's been such a big part of Chris's life and the family. We really sort of anchored to it because it's been a great, almost like a household name, so to speak, and around the West and around Queensland. And none of us wanted to see it go.
The goods are being sold down the road at Peter's old-time music and food hall. And while baking runs in the family's blood, the craft came about from hardship.
In 1945, My late aunt's, my father's sister, she was married to the baker up there at Mareeba during the war. She got run over by a US Army truck. Mm. As the story, as I know it, what happened was after that, her husband sort of, family, they had the bakery, and it all sort of went pear-shaped for them after that, and Dad's older brothers took it over, and then Dad got into the trade that way.
Eventually their dad, Monty Tills, or Snow, as he was referred to because of his white hair as a young lad, came to Alpha and opened Snow's Bakery.
What happened was when the bakery burnt to the ground in 1976, Chris was 18, and, of course, there was no money to build another one at the time. And that's when he started moving around baking, and he came back and he went to Aramac and started the bakery there, and probably early 90s he decided he'd reopen one here.
Peter hopes Snow's pies will satisfy hungry travellers and wants everyone to know they're open for business with the same family pie recipe that was passed down from his dad. Pies he loves so much, he wrote a song about them.
The real reason I started coming back down here was to try and help Chris feel like he belonged to something, so he could anchor to something and feel like himself again.
That's Peter Tills ending that report by Hannah Walsh. Now, before I let you go from the Country Hour, I just want to tell you a bit of a feel-good story about a parrot who loves a good party, and he's been found safe on a farm 6 days and 31 kilometres from where she disappeared before a huge thunderstorm recently in southeast Queensland. Jennifer Nichols has the story of one parrot, several shiny beer cans, and one very relieved family.
Ivy is a friendly Alexandrine parrot who loves a crowd and a shiny beer can. After chewing her way out of an aviary in Gympie on Monday last week, the pampered pet had to survive predators, torrential rain, lightning, a heat wave, and cyclonic winds that tore down trees. All the time, Freya Erlandson and her partner Jack Tompkins were looking for her.
I'd wake up at 4 a.m. go calling and driving around for a couple of hours calling for her, and in the afternoon do the same thing, and after maybe day 5 or 6 I was starting to give up hope, and then you can hear her on my shoulder. She wants to tell everyone about her adventure.
Ivy landed safely on a farm at Koondu, neighbouring the storm-smashed Tallara State Forest near the Great Sandy National Park.
Just flew straight in onto one of my male friend's shoulders and perched herself there.
Marie Usher was hosting a party for 50 friends.
And started drinking, trying to, you know, get into his can of beer. She just made herself completely welcome. Everybody had a lovely time with her. So she loves people, obviously.
After being provided with water and parrot-appropriate food, the call went out via social media to find Ivy's owners, a couple who knows only too well Ivy's fondness for a party. She'd been adopted by Miss Erlandson 3 years ago after gate-crashing happy hour at a retirement village to steal crackers and wine.
Ivy came to us as a miracle and then had a nightmare a week, and we were brought with another miracle of having her come back to us and by the community, and it was insane. The drive there was just pure excitement, in shock. I didn't believe it was her. I thought, how could she have come that far? And the drive there is nothing but thick forests, like farmlands. There was macadamia forests. There was mango farms. I was like, how did she end up this far in only a short amount of time?
I think it was meant to be that you were reunited.
Yes, definitely. Everything that came together, everything in the community, I wouldn't have been able to do it without them.
The couple is now looking forward to celebrating Christmas with Ivy at home, with more crackers and some crunchy cans.
I still don't believe it, honestly. It's a miracle, Christmas miracle.
Well, welcome home, Ivy. That story from Jennifer Nichols. News is coming up next. It's 1 o'clock.